Dargrave Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. Autumn semester 2009, this is Business Finance FIL 240, Section 6. Lecture 11, delivered on September 22, 2009. The title of this lecture is Risk and Return.
Today, Risk and Return. And I want to make a slight amendment, and you might want to write it in your notes. When I write risk and return, what I am actually talking about is expected return. That's important to understand. We do not have a crystal ball. We cannot see the future with certainty unless it is right in front of us. If you are standing on a train track and there's a train coming at you and it's about 20 feet away, you're pretty sure of what the outcome of that's going to be, and it's going to be, shall we say, adverse to you. But looking a little further into the future, you really can't know what return would be. You expect some outcome for taking a risk. The first principle is the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. You are not going to take risk stupidly. You are not going to bear risk unless you expect something out of it. No one will do that unless he or she no one will take risk without some judgment that something is going to come of it that is beneficial. Now, that might be an ill-informed opinion. That might be just a wild guess. It might not be particularly reasonable, but we shall assume that it is rational. But it is the greater the risk, the greater the expected return. Now, when I talk about risk, we have different ways of measuring risk. We could just talk about risk in terms of how much you cringe when you think about doing something. Oh, God. Oh, geez, Zoe, no way. We could talk about risk in some visceral gut way. And really, when people assess risk, they think about it in those terms. They don't make some mathematical calculation. In business, we do. But in normal people's lives, they take some kind of an assessment of risk in terms of how much it scares them, or how much it excites them, or how much they feel some internal sense of adventure in doing something. But in business, we have to have a metric for risk. And more importantly, we have to have a metric for several kinds of risk. Because you see, there are different kinds of risk that you can take. There is overall risk, but that risk is divided into two parts for economic and financial considerations. One part is risk that is avoidable. Risk that you don't have to take. In finance, we call that diversifiable risk. And then there is risk that is inherent that you can't get rid of. That is non-diversifiable risk. Non-diversifiable. And you'll see what that means a little later when we talk about portfolio diversification. But non-diversifiable risk is the risk for which you will be rewarded. You aren't going to be rewarded just for risk. You will be rewarded for risk that cannot be removed, cannot be eliminated, cannot be set aside. Because a market is not going to reward you for being stupid. A market might very well reward you, and you could very well expect to be rewarded for risk that is not avoidable. But no efficient market is going to reward you for risk that you could have avoided, simply because you might have avoided that risk. You chose not to. So what? How am I going to formulate my reward? I'm going to formulate it on the basis of the person who took only the risk that was necessary, that couldn't be avoided. So if you are going to take, for example, well, let me not do that. In finance, when we're thinking of cash flow, there is a risk factor in cash flow. And if we were to look at cash flow over time, we might see the cash flow going all over the place, like that. In there is risk. The risk that the cash flow is going to be lower than you expect, or lower than you might anticipate. The risk, and there is a risk that it's going to be higher than you anticipate. And so ultimately, what we are talking about, and you'll hear this term in portfolio management, we're talking about volatility, how much it moves around. Volatility, how much it moves around. High volatility would be associated with high risk. Low volatility would be associated with low risk. And also, how likely is some wild swing to happen? How likely is it? First things first, the mean, which you will see me write as the Greek letter mu. Really, really, we don't know the mean. We will estimate the mean possibly by something, a statistic called X bar. That's the estimate of the mean. And here is the formula for the mean. The mean would be the sum of the probabilities of the outcomes from I equals 1 to n possible outcomes. The probability times, and I'll use cash flow for my, times the cash flow in the ith state. State 1, 2, 3, and 4, probability of the state. And the probability of the state here, let's say state 1 would be 0.5, state 2 would be 0.40, state 3 would be 0.20, and state 4 would be 0.35. Now, the sum of the probabilities has to add up to 1. In probability theory, we say that we have a probability density function. We have exhausted all the possible states of the system here. We've exhausted. There is nothing that we haven't covered, okay? That's what we mean when we say these add up to 1.00, okay? Now, let's look at cash flows. And let's just do a quick, dirty little example here. Cash flow in the state, okay? Now, there is a probability of 0.05 of a cash flow of $50,000. There is a probability of 0.40 that the cash flow will be $80,000. There's a probability of 20% that the cash flow will be $60,000. And there's a probability of 0.35 that the cash flow will be $40,000. We actually, this looks kind of simplistic and lame, but in a lot of ways, we formulate in real circumstances, and I've done this, where I simply, for some quick analysis of a company, I'd say, okay, let's talk about different economic circumstances. We might have one where we have a mild recession, we have a very good recovery, we have sort of a floppy recovery, and then we have probability that the recession will be a little bit worse than otherwise we might want. So we might give sort of different states for different possible economies over the next year, through the next year. That would be one place where we would do this kind of state analysis like this. And then all you do from here is say, okay, the mean is going to be, in this case, 0.05 times 50,000 plus 0.40 times 80,000 plus 0.2020 times 60,000 plus 0.35 times 40,000. I hope that's right. And geez, I wish I could remember. I did this, I've done the same example so many times and I can never remember. 50 times 40 times. And I do hope to God I got that right. Correct me if I am wrong. I've warned you before, I really suck at arithmetic. I'm getting a mean of $60,500. Is that right? Well, thank you. Thank goodness. Okay, now, what I'm doing here is I am saying the expected value of the cash flow is $60,500. That's how I talk about that. You'll hear me use, instead of mean, I'll say the expected cash flow is $60,500. Taking into account four different states that could occur and the probabilities of each state occurring, I have an expected cash flow of $60,500. But if I look at this model here that I have laid out, that $60,500, yeah, that tells me what on average would happen. But boy, there's quite a bit of swing there. I mean, it could be as much as $20,500 less than that value. So in other words, this expected value does not capture the whole story. It does not capture it at all. Because in this story is the possibility that I could end up $20,500, about a third below, more than a third, below what I expect to happen. So I need a second measure. I need a second measure of this. Something that will tell me about that width of the cash flow possibilities. And that's the term that we sometimes, at least I do, and we used to use that in the past, talk not just about the center, but about the width of the cash flow possibilities. And to do that, we go to a second measure, the standard deviation, which will be the sum, well, actually the square root of the sum of the probabilities of each one times the cash flow less the expected value squared. Now, this is one measure. There are others. There are several others, in fact. And the reason we use this measure as sort of our basis for talking about volatility, the reason we do this is because it has some nice theoretical properties, and we can play with it and make some assertions about what we have gotten from it. The reason, by the way, we do this squaring is so that positive and negative deviations from the center do not cancel each other out. We square it just for that purpose. That's the main purpose. So that if I have a cash flow that's above the mean, it does not cancel out a cash flow below the mean. When we square them, they always come out to be positive. So in this case, we would have the sigma come out to be the square root of, well, this is going to be a pain in the ass, 0.05 times 50,000 less 60,500 squared plus, well, this is a lot like work, 0.40 times 80,000 minus, if I had the sense I was born with, I'd take off these zeros to do this, less 60,500 squared plus 0.20 times 60,000 minus 60,500 squared plus 0.35 times 40,000 less 60,500 squared. And now, I strongly encourage you to beat this out with me here. For one thing, because I really don't get the answer sometimes that I would like. Enter 6,500 minus GER. Stupid small print. I can't read the stupid calculator. GER. And I do these deliberately instead of just pulling out the answers for you. 6,500 minus 2 squared. I blew it already. Why can't I do a calculation without making a mistake? This again. That's okay. On that's 10,500 squared times 0.05 plus 19,500 squared times 0.4 plus 500 squared times 0.2 plus 0.35 times 20,500 squared equals. Now, I am not going to guarantee you that this is right, but I am getting $17,457. Is that right? Oh, thank God. Okay, look. And this is dollars, by the way. Dollars. Okay, we've got a number. And one of the nice things with these numbers is if you make a mistake, they oftentimes will blow up and look ridiculous. It helps to just stop, step back, and say, reality check. Does that look like it's about what it should be? The answer is, well, it's kind of in the range of the numbers we started with, and that's going to help us a lot to tell us, yeah, this is probably the right answer, and if it's not, I worked awfully hard to get it, so bite me. I did my best. But what does that mean? Take the average, 60,500, the expected value. Now add $17,457 to it. And then also take that $60,500 and subtract $17,457 from it. Okay? And for God's sake, will someone please help me here? $6,500 minus $17,457. By the way, I didn't do the cents on that. And the reason is because I started with dollars. The cents are spurious accuracy for this. So if I do that, take $60,500 minus $17,457, I get $43,043. And if I take $60,500 plus $17,457, I would get $77,957. Okay. What does that tell me? What that tells me is that this spread is from the mean right here of $60,500. I want to make sure I got a note right here. Yeah, that's right. Just want to make sure I got something. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. There's a little notation difference. I'll caution you. I think there's a little notation difference between the book, how the book wrote that and how I did. It comes out to be the same thing. I'm not sure, though, but it comes out to be the same thing. Look, this is one standard deviation below the mean to one standard deviation above the mean, okay, above the expected value. So that's approximately... There's a 67% probability that the actual cash flow that will happen is in that band right there. There's a 67% chance that the actual cash flow that will happen will be in that band. Okay, that's what that basically tells you, provided you have a relatively normal distribution underlying this process you were doing here. And here we had an awful small sample size, so I can't swear to that much, but we'll just assert it. So what we're saying here is that if I were on a cash flow line with $60,500 at the center of it, I would know that I would have a 67% chance, and I know I'm repeating myself here, but I'm just trying to emphasize this, of the cash flow actually being in that band right there, from $43,043 to $77,957. I would also know this. I would also know this. Take that 17,000. Well, let me write it this way. 60,500 minus 2 times 17,457. And then take the 60,500 plus 2 times the $17,457. Two standard deviations. And if I do that, the numbers come out. Yeah. Wait. Try that again. Clear. Okay, 60,500 minus 2 times 17,457 is $25,586 on the downside. 60,500 plus 2 times 17,457. $95,414 on the top side. So, what I now know also is that there is a 95% chance about that the cash flow will be somewhere between $25,586 on the downside and $95,414 on the upside. That's what I know. Notice how, as I want more certainty that I'm right, I have to expand my possibilities quite a bit. Okay, I'm fairly sure that you're a guy. I'm really sure that you're a guy or a girl. See how to get more sure, I have to hedge my bet more. To get more sure of a cash flow, I have to hedge the band, the widen the band more. So the more certain you are, given a set of data, the more certain you are, the more certain you want to be, the less certain you're going to get, as odd as that might seem. And this is just one of those things. When someone says, well, I'm 99% sure, well, that ought to be associated with a pretty wide band, unless there's a lot of data. As you increase the amount of data, you will actually tighten it up. It will tighten up nicely. But for all intents and purposes, if you want more certainty that you have the right number, you're going to have to open this band up more. So in a case like this, if I take this back to less of a theoretical and do some calculations and answer a more meaningful question, well, what does this mean for a company if it's predicting cash flow? Well, let's say I have asked, how certain do you want me to be? Well, I want you to be 95% sure. Okay, then I can tell you right now that we'll be somewhere on the cash flow between $25,586 and $95,414. So what does that mean? In terms of planning, that would mean, okay, in a worst-case scenario, if I want to be 95% sure that my ass is covered in a worst-case scenario, I need to look at $25,586 as how much money we're going to have in cash flow. That's what that tells me. You want me to be 95% sure? Well, then let's plan for the disaster of only $25,586. But you said you expected us to come out at $60,500. Yes, I did. But if you want 95% certainty that we've got a plan to handle worst, then you have to talk to me about, then we have to have a conversation about what we do if all we have is $25,586. That's what this actually would mean in application, is if I need that kind of certainty, and actually that's a reasonable thing. Let's say I need to be 95% sure that we're going to be okay here. Well, let's plan for that number right there, being how much we're going to have to work with as far as cash flow goes. And so this does have teeth to it. It does have meaning, and it has meaning in a lot of different circumstances within a company. When you're talking about costs, when you're talking about revenue, when you're talking about all kinds of different things, to actually look at what the numbers are telling you and to plan for that worst-case scenario. You can even do this in operations management. Have you taken your operations management course yet? You'll see that we actually do these kinds of things in operations management quite a bit. Looking at, well, how, in terms of, okay, what will, if we need to be 95% certain or 97.5% certain that we are covered on our production, then let's talk about what would be the worst case cost scenario that we would have to consider. And it would be, in that case, we'd be looking at the top number there in that. Now, taking this back over here, there's at the heart of any kind of a calculation like this, you have this judgment call here on the probabilities of the states. First of all, make sure that you have enough states to cover reasonable scenarios. Second, make sure that you are being reasonable about what the probabilities are. Don't just guess. There are actually places you can go and find out what the best assessments of the probabilities of different economic scenarios are, different industry scenarios. There are places out there you can go and see. Well, there is this Council of Economic Advisors. They consider maybe three states of the economy: boom, stagnation, bust. Look at what their probabilities are. Start with those as a basis. And also, it doesn't hurt for you to think about the history of your own experience in the corporation or in the analysis. But that's the basic of how we measure just raw volatility. Raw volatility is with the standard deviations. And what we do from here in actual finance, in portfolio analysis, and all of that, starts with finding an expected value and finding a standard deviation. It all boils down to that. And just for some reason, I'm just bothered by some notational thing that I did there. I don't know. Huh. I don't know. My oh well. Okay, well. Okay, whatever. I'm not going to worry too much about it. There does seem to be something a little bit bothersome about that. Okay, now. Now, I'm going to jump ahead here a little bit. I'm going to move this a little forward here. Because one of the things that I don't like to do is just spend an entire class just doing raw mathematics, because it kind of takes away the point of why we do mathematics in finance. We're always doing these things to answer a question or to prepare ourselves for something that is a deeper analysis than just simple numbers on a whiteboard or on a piece of paper. Look, at the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves, how do markets quantify risk? If you were to, for example, go to a bank, you would probably not hear a banker say standard deviation. If you looked in the financial newspaper, you would probably not, well, you might, but you'd have to really look hard, I think, to see standard deviation or expected value or anything like that. You wouldn't see these kinds of numbers. We know that these are the backdrop. We know that what's happening has this as the sort of like the underlying process. These numbers are being calculated in some visceral way by markets. But what does a market use for risk? The market obviously has to have a number. But what is it? What would be visible? I mean, there are visible to a financial person. Some of us, we could probably find these numbers, you know, the standard deviation, the expected value. But that's not what we would see in a real-world context. What is the number that businesses, that people actually see that is measuring risk? That is flagging different risks of different projects, of different things. What is it? You got? I love it when you talk like that. You've ruined it. You're no fun anymore. Yes, it's interest rates. They're what the market uses. That is the market's signaling flag for risk. A credit card has an interest rate of, let's say, 18%, but at the same time, a student loan has a lower interest rate. You have a student loan? Oh, I'm so tired of people being debt-free. I'm sick of it. Good. I want you in debt up to your ears when you get out of here. So you have to work at a Jiffy Lube as an assistant manager. But you see, here's the thing. No, okay, full manager within 2 years, provided you wear a crisp shirt every day. Okay, mind you, woman, concentrate. You see, if you were to give me a loan, you'd probably charge me a terrible interest rate. If you were to give Donald Trump a loan, even though the man drives about every business he's ever operated into the dust, you'd give him a lower interest rate. Because you are assessing the risk of it. You see, with a house, a home loan, a fixed rate mortgage, that's actually a very low risk loan. It's surprisingly low risk. You hear these stories about these banks blubbering about how we've had so many mortgages go into default, blubber, blubber. Well, the story is that actually they've got the asset. They'll just take the asset. Well, now the asset might have fallen in value, so there's a risk there. Yes, but in almost all cases, they had insurance that was covering the difference between the home value and the loan value. So there is very little risk in those loans. That's why a home loan can be at a low interest rate, is because there is a low risk involved. Now, suppose that you had something that was actually a little higher in risk. Now, think about a car. A new car, the loan on a new car. Now, as soon as you drive a new car off the lot, you lose a considerable amount of value. That's just the way it's going to be. And the value declines relatively steeply over, and we're talking about economic value here. Economic value declines rather steeply over a relatively short number of years. You own a car? What year is it? 02? Well, that thing is, I don't want to hurt your feelings, but the thing probably sucks as far as the resale value goes. Maybe $1,500? I know, it's probably more than that. But it's certainly not anywhere near what it was worth when you bought it. The value declines relatively steeply, possibly faster than the loan value does as you amortize the loan. Okay? Probably. Well, at least for a while. Certainly right away. As soon as you drive that car off the lot, that value drops. So you're upside down on the loan for a while anyway. And you hope that you recover as time goes along. However, you got 0% financing. Low, low prices and 0% financing if you order before midnight. So how do you assess that? What do you say? Oh, geez, that's a great interest rate. This is an incredible deal. Or is it? No, it's not. The interest rate is not reflecting the true risk. But the auto dealer is not stupid. He was not born at night, and it certainly wasn't last night. He didn't just get off the banana boat. So if he is offering you a very low interest rate, a 0%, a 1.99% interest rate, you know very well that the loan is riskier than that interest rate. So what does that tell you? How can you assess it? What's your final determination of this? Is he just stupid and he's giving away cars below the risk level that he should be? Go.
After the first month, the interest rate will go up.
Yeah, you probably look at the fine print. There's a balloon or in the interest rate. There's an adjustment. Or there is something in the price of the car that is taking care of that issue, okay? That's the problem, is that there will always be a reward for bearing risk. Our typical understanding is the interest rate. If the interest rate doesn't look right for the risk of the instrument relative to other instruments, then it's probably because the reward for bearing the risk is being hidden someplace else. It's being buried in some other part of the loan. But interest rates measure risk. We have all kinds of other ways to measure risk, but at its heart, an interest rate is the way a market flags risk. Markets cannot provide extraordinarily complicated, multidimensional analyses of risk. They have to give something that can be used and used on the fly and can be used across a whole range of instruments. So, for example, I would see the yield on a one-year T-bill at 0.20%, not too far off from where they are right now, sad. And I would see the yield on, let us say, and I'm just pulling one out of the air here. On a Microsoft 30-year, I would see at 6.25%. Right off the top of your head, which one is clearly flagging as a riskier instrument? Right off the top of your head, what do you see? And you'd say, well, duh, Microsoft, yeah. Well, that's exactly the point. The interest rate is a one-stop measure that there is more risk in the second instrument than there is in the first. And then you can ask, okay, what is the source? What are the sources of the risk? Well, in this model, now you remember what I told you about the risk structure of an interest rate? What's going on here? Where are the sources of risk that is differentiating the one-year T-bill from the 30-year Microsoft? What are they? You remember what I told you about those? I will ask you that on the exam. Talk to me. What are the sources? Which one's more likely to default?
Oh, Microsoft.
Yeah, the government will not default. No, it won't. They will simply print money to pay you off if they have to. They'll borrow it from the Chinese or the Indians or the Europeans or the Japanese. They will pay you off. They will take care of it. So there's default risk. Default risk is adding to this. What else? So there's a default premium. A premium for the risk of default. There is no risk of default in a government instrument. But there is a risk of default, small as it is, there is a risk of default in the Microsoft bond. And I don't even know if Microsoft issues 30-year bonds, but we'll just pretend they do. What else is driving risk here? Go ahead. Oh, well, actually, interestingly enough, there is an expected inflation premium. You see, if inflation is going to hit, it would probably hit longer out, farther out than 1 year. More than likely, when the bad inflation hits, it's going to hit out there farther. And also, as the instrument is longer in duration, the compounding effect of inflation will be significant. On a 30-year instrument. You compound inflation at a rate of 3% for 30 years, geez, that's a lot. And of course, that would not hit a one-year instrument nearly as bad. I wasn't expecting that one, so actually, I thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. Now, what was what I was looking for? Where's the other source of risk here? There's another source of risk that is clear, ringing like a bell here. I've actually written it there. Maturity premium. Yes. Maturity premium. You see, over the life of this Microsoft instrument, if interest rates go up, and I'm holding a Microsoft 6.25, then I'm going to take an ass bath on this thing because I got something at 6.25. I'd really, really love to invest in something at about the same risk level as Microsoft that's now issuing 8%. But I'm stuck with Microsoft. So that is definitely going to adversely affect me. And it doesn't matter whether interest rates really do go up or go down. The fact of the matter is that it is a possibility that it could happen. And if there is a probability of it happening, that adds one more level to that table that I did there, thereby increasing volatility. And volatility is risk. Every time I add one more row to that table that I'm doing there, especially a row that's outside of the typical range, I'm adding volatility. Therefore, I have more chance for volatility. I have more chance for volatility. Let's try this. We're going to take an all-terrain vehicle, sir. You're going to get in the driver's seat, I'm going to drive, and we are going to go to the Grand Canyon. We are going to be maybe about 30 feet from the sheer cliffs and the death below and the skeletons that are already down there and the wrecked cars. Okay, I'm going to give you a choice. I can either hit the accelerator for 1 minute or for 30 minutes. Which one is going to present you with more risk, you would think? You see, because there's just more chance that we're going to go over that cliff. And we might live, but at the same time, if it's a sheer cliff, we're going, Concentrate. Okay, you see, that's the point, is that just with the longer duration, there's going to be... Have you ever been on a roller coaster and you just hope to God that it was over with? I've been there. I mean, you know, if this were 1 minute, hey, that'd be cool. But the thing is going on and on. I've seen dead relatives. I've got to pee. And it's terrible. You don't want it to go on that long. Basic training. It would have been wonderful if it had been a day. Wow, that was fun. After about 6 weeks, getting called maggot, oh, it got old. You see, it's the duration that makes it a miserable experience. And that's the thing is, that because you've got this duration that's longer, you have more chances for really ugly things to occur. The same would apply, have you ever been in a haunted house? Okay, when you're in a haunted house for 1 minute, there's not much of a problem with it. You know, if something says, get out, you can leave. But what if they lock the doors behind you like they did in that Stephen King novel? You're stuck there all night, getting slapped around the walls, having ectoplasm pour all over your body and make you feel all greasy. Where the hell was I? I don't know how that relates, but you see, what I'm trying to get to here is that when you have more time for volatility to put its teeth into you, that's really a source of risk. And that can be a real driver of high interest rates. Like, you know, these adjustable rate mortgages. They have these really great low interest rates when you start. Well, that's because they can adjust the interest rate every year on you or every 5 years. They have more latitude to adjust to volatility. With a 30-year fixed rate mortgage, they got to put the interest rate high enough to take into account all of the possible bad things that could happen over 30 years. With a 1-year ARM or even a 5-year ARM, they don't have to take into account all of those possible bad things over 30 years because they get to adjust it in 5 years or 1 year. Of course, they're always going to adjust it up on you. I've never seen one go, well, maybe I did. But anyway, at the end of the day, that's what risk is all about, is for in the real world, we're going to be using interest rates as our primary tool to measure risk. We're going to use those in tandem at some points with other metrics for risk, standard deviation, and there's going to be one that we use later called beta. Beta is a very cool, very extremely cool thing, and this is something that anyone who's a serious investor should know about, is the beta of a stock or the beta of a portfolio. We could even talk about the beta of an industry if we want to. It's a way to measure the risk of, let's say, a stock against the risk volatility of a very well-balanced, ginormous portfolio. So ultimately, what I'm trying to get to here is when I look at a T-bill, I'm getting very, very close. Now, and I've already mentioned this before, but I'm getting very, very close, although not right on. I'm getting a very close approximation of a risk-free rate, of a rate of return that would have nothing but the real reward for foregone consumption plus an expected inflation premium. I'm getting very, very close to a risk-free rate. Okay? Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a window ahead here to finish this one off for the day. If I were to be able to say, all right, I know something. I know a portfolio that has shaken out all of the diversifiable risk. All that's in this portfolio would be pure, unavoidable, non-diversifiable risk. Suppose that I knew a portfolio that was like that. Okay. Well, let me talk about the return on that portfolio. The yield on it, for lack of a better word. And let me call that R sub M. That return, that interest rate on that portfolio represents the reward for bearing risk that is completely unavoidable. This is the reward that a market would have to give for someone to be stupid enough to join in on this risky venture. You couldn't get any less than that or no one would be interested. You give more than that, someone's going to bid it down to that. So this thing right here would be the reward, or maybe the expected return, we could say, to this pure, beautiful portfolio that has only raw, unavoidable risk in it. Okay. Now I'm going to take that and I'm going to subtract the risk-free rate. And this would be the premium for taking the risk of the pure portfolio over taking no risk with your investment. Okay. So in other words, if I told you that the return to this perfect portfolio was, oh, let's say 14%, and a T-bill was yielding, let's say, 2%, then my premium for doing this, this risky pure portfolio, would be 12%. Okay? That'd be your reward for taking risk instead of taking no risk with an investment. You can always put your money into a T-bill and take no risk. But if you're going to take risk, pure risk, that is completely okay to take, then this will be your extra reward for that. 12% would be your extra reward. Okay, now we call this R sub M, the market portfolio, the return to the market portfolio. It would be taking every security, every stock maybe of every company in proportion to the weight of that value of that company in the economy as a whole. You're never going to be able to do that, but you can get awfully close with mutual funds. If you buy just plain old straight stocks, you can't do this because they have both non-diversifiable risk and huge amounts of diversifiable risk. So we're not talking about investments in one single stock. This would be a monster portfolio. And like I said, you can buy mutual funds that very closely mirror this, come within any degree of accuracy you would want, possibly. But anyway, look. So this is the market portfolio. This is the risk-free rate. So this is the premium to the market portfolio. You can always just invest in T-bills and have no risk at all, except for your inflation risk. If you invest in the market portfolio, this R sub M minus R sub F is your extra reward. That's your extra reward. Now, this extra reward, we can put a metric on this extra reward based upon any stock. It is closely related to the sigma, the standard deviation, but it's called beta. Beta is the factor by which the volatility of a given stock relates to the volatility of a market, of the market portability of the market portfolio. And this is a very loose definition, but it works really nicely for my purposes. So if I told you the beta of a stock was 1.2, that would mean that it had 120% of the volatility of the market portfolio. If I told you that the beta of a stock was 0.5, it has 50% of the volatility of a market portfolio. So you would look in a financial newspaper and you'd look at, and you could find betas very easily. And you could tell the risk of any given stock relative to the risk of a perfectly diversified portfolio. So if I look at a stock and I say, well, the beta of this stock is 0.25, what would you tell me about the riskiness of this stock? Is it high or is it low?
It would be 25%, right?
Right.
Relatively,
just say
relatively low.
Low, not relatively. That's really low. That's a, what would you guess? What would you guess would be the beta of a treasury bill, a one-year treasury bill? What would be the beta of it? This is actually kind of tricky. Once I tell you, it'll be kind of like, duh, but it might not be.
It's either way high or way low. I'm just not sure which one.
That's very good. What's the standard deviation of that bet? Anyone want to take a stab? What would be the beta of a treasury bill? Does it have any risk? Yeah, zero. It'd have a beta of zero. It would actually have no volatility relative to the market portfolio. It's perfectly riskless. So it has 0% of the volatility of the market portfolio. Now, here's another tricky one. Just to get you into the thinking mode of these, because beta is where we're headed. This is the very cool one. When you say beta, people think you know something about stocks. What do you suppose the beta of the market portfolio is? Perfect. Give him a cookie. That was not bad. 100%. Pat him on the back. Well, please, really. Good man. It's 100%. Well, what's the volatility of the market portfolio relative to the volatility of the market portfolio? 100%. Yeah. See, so you actually have these markers along the way. Here's the strange thing. You can see volatility. You can see betas. I mean, if you, and this would tell you, how burly are you? You want to take a portfolio that has a beta of, let's say, 3? Well, that is really husky. Or you could be a really cowardly investor and have a portfolio or buy a stock that has a beta of 0.2, 0.1. And then that would obviously be a very defensive, very low risk, low expected return stock. very cool thing that you can use this. Interestingly enough, there are actually some betas that are negative. And it's almost, at first you kind of think, oh, how could that be? It's actually a reverse volatility of the market. In other words, it actually doesn't ride with the market. It rides counter to the market. Gold mining stocks tend to have slightly negative betas. Sometimes have slightly negative betas. As a matter of fact, there are mutual funds that you can buy into. They're called reverse funds that are deliberately built to have negative betas. So in other words, if you think that you're a contrarian and you think that the market's going to get it wrong, well, then you could, or something like, I don't know what you do, but you can actually go into these reverse funds that actually would ride against the volatility of the market. And I've known people who've been very big on reverse funds that have made a fortune. And then, of course, there are other people who've taken a butt bath doing it, too. But these are different things that you can do. Once you have the idea of beta down, just in and out, and I haven't even given you how you use beta yet fully. It's got a lot of power behind it. But you'll see very soon the beta is actually just derived from standard deviation. So that standard deviation is not just a wasted calculation. You can do some very extremely cool things with it. But right now, I would encourage you, if you have the chance, go to just like Google, finance.google.com, and just type in some stock, the symbol for some stock, AOL, MFS, MSFT, IBM, something like that. You will see right up there at the top, one of the metrics that they give you is the beta. And you will see right there, oh, I understand what the beta is. Beta is a measure of risk. Beta tells me the volatility of this security relative to a highly diversified market portfolio's volatility. And so you can then, sometimes it'll surprise you. You will look at different betas and you will see, well, sometimes a beta is actually surprisingly low compared to what I would have thought. I would have thought this is kind of a risky company. No, the beta is low. Why would you think it's a risky company? Because a lot of the risk is diversifiable risk, and no one's going to reward you for diversifiable risk. Surprisingly enough, the risk of this stock in a well-diversified portfolio is actually very low. Other times, you'll think something is a relatively safe stock. You'll look at the volatility. You'll look at the beta, and you'll say, geez, that's more risky than I thought it was. Beta is one of our chief measures of risk, and it will be one of them that drives a lot of our financial analysis in this course when we get down to the level where we are actually finding the present value of future expected cash flows. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.